Our guest today is Billy Blair. Billy is the president and CEO of a company called Leading and Learning, Inc. And Leading and Learning, Inc. provides consulting services to the corporate world as in organizational change management. What we have asked Billy to do today with us is to talk to us about succession planning, probably the single most important change that any organization can face. Billy, thanks for joining us today. I look forward to our discussion.
Oh, hello, Ed. Thanks very much for having me on your show. It seems like it's going to be a great show, and I look forward to our discussion.
Our topic today is succession planning, something many law firms do not do, but should, and probably most of corporate America doesn't do until it's too late, and we have many examples of that from Hewlett-Packard on down. But when we talk about succession planning, what exactly are we talking about? What does this mean? What's our definition?
Succession planning is a process that corporations, we always advise our corporate clients to go through as early in their process as they possibly can, and it is looking ahead to the leaders that they might have coming up and deciding amongst that group, that crop of possible new leaders, who has the talent to be in certain positions and who has the talent and the interest, plus if they had just a little bit of additional support, could be dynamite CEOs or other C-level folks. So it's looking toward their future and looking for the positions that are going to be available in their future.
In other words, somebody or some group of people, whether it be a board of directors or a management committee, I think you're saying have to identify sort of the next generation of leaders. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. What we suggest is that it be the CEO and his or her leadership team that does that identification, of course, in conjunction with and blessing of their board of directors, but it really should be the management folks that are doing this because they're in the closest contact with the as I said, the new crop of potential leaders. And the first step, of course, in all of this is that the CEO has to realize that one day he or she will step down. And sometimes that's the first hurdle.
The first hurdle is to admit one's own mortality.
Exactly.
Let me jump ahead, if I may, because I've heard many stories, although have not personally experienced this, where it becomes obvious who is the heir apparent, so to speak, or which small group of folks are the heir apparent. And then all of a sudden, there's sort of a competition among those folks, and ill will is created, whereas before they seem to have been working harmoniously as a team. How do you avoid that kind of disharmony?
My favorite story is has to do with the Kaiser Permanente CEO when he was a candidate for the CEO's position, and he has told me this personally. And that is his the person who was also competing for the position later became the second in command, did not get the position. And that CEO went to great lengths. Part of that was to have an executive coach come in and work with all of them, the outgoing CEO, the new CEO, and the other fellow who didn't get the position, so that they formed a very close-knit leadership team that carried the organization in its first 2 years under the new regime. So there are many strategies. That's just one. But because it's so real life and came from a person in the position, I like to repeat it because it shows that with good care and good planning, those kinds of disagreeable situations can certainly be avoided.
And we'll overlook the great pun that you used of good care in reference to Kaiser Permanente. Let me ask you the next question then, and that is, in what businesses, what industries, what companies that you can identify has succession planning really been used successfully?
I'm going to talk a little bit generically because I'm a licensed organizational psychologist, and our businesses run under my offices, so I can't talk about our own clients and name them by name. But I do know of many others who haven't been our clients that I can talk about. One of those, often succession planning happens most naturally in businesses that are family-run businesses. And there's the Marriott hotel chain that has for several rounds of CEOs remained in the family and had a Marriott at its head as the CEO. And they're just beginning to look at whether that's the best circumstance for the future for Marriott. And but at any rate, the point there is that they have for many rounds of CEOs done very good succession planning in that they knew who was going to be coming up. They groomed that person well, and the person took over that large enterprise in a seamless fashion.
Well, I guess another example would be Ford Motor Company, at least up until recent times,
yes,
where they seem to maintain and retain a member of the family at the head.
Yes, until just very recently. Bill Ford was the last Ford in many, many years, and they made the decision to select someone else. But it was done in a very good succession planning way.
Well, are there particular industries that succession planning seems to have worked better than others? We can identify individual companies as we have in a couple of instances now. But what about industries as a whole? Or is this really a company-specific kind of analysis?
Yeah, I don't know of any instances where there are just total industries that where succession planning works better in one type of industry than another. It does work extremely well, of course, in very large corporations, simply because they almost have to look ahead, or they certainly should be looking ahead, and most do, to the down the way and to their future. It also, as we've mentioned, works very well in family-owned businesses, and as you know, many of those, like the Hyatt hotel chain and Marriott that we've talked about, are very large corporations, they carefully select their people that are coming up. The banking industry is fairly well known at doing succession planning and doing it pretty well, as is the hospitality industry, and there are many other instances we could name. IBM is another that's done a very good job of that, and on, but it jumps around. It's not necessarily industry specific, but you know, the field that you're in, as a matter of fact, the law practice and law partnerships is one where certainly there are very good instances of succession planning. There are times when that isn't necessarily done, so we could recommend it for law practices, but it's a natural for closely held companies as well, such as law practices are.
Well, is there anything different about the manufacturing companies or the service industry as contrasted with professional service organizations such as law firms that we have to take a look at or be sensitive to when we discuss succession planning?
Yes, absolutely. Manufacturing and other industries that are similar tend to be more disparate, and by that I mean they're in this modern day of corporate structures and entities, they're more widely flung, far flung. Many of those industries have operations all over the world, and so it's a little bit dicier for those corporations to think about succession planning because their people are everywhere. And in many instances, their people speak many languages, so it's a matter of figuring out ways to get bring all of that information together. Practices such as law firms and professional firms such as mine and yours, for example, we are more closely associated. We sort of march to the same drummers, and we know one another very well because law firms and professional service firms such as consulting firms tend to be smaller, even though my firm, a 35-person firm, is largest for management consulting. It's still considered, of course, a small business. So we associate more closely. We know one another well, and it's easier in that regard to know people's strengths and you know, some of their less than stellar qualities, and therefore more readily tap the person that might be the natural successor.
Well, what are some of the pitfalls that our listeners should be careful about when they think in terms of succession planning?
Well, one is that I think the biggest pitfall is that they don't think of succession planning. But if they're into succession planning and have embraced the idea and planned it to follow through, then the first pitfall that we usually come across is people who have tried it. You know, it's sort of like, don't try this at home kind of thing. Don't try it without your professional consultant helping. When they've tried it and failed, it generally is that they've misperceived what succession planning actually is. And it really isn't just picking someone who's the favorite of the CEO. In fact, that's the very worst thing that could be done. The succession planning is an entire strategy that combines looking at the leadership talent, assessing that talent with good psychological testing, and I don't mean looking for mental deficiencies, that kind of psychological testing, but we, in the organizational psychology business, we have excellent leadership assessments that tell us exactly where the strengths and where the needs for beefing up in any given instance, individual instance, is. And so we use all of those kinds of information points, data points, to assist the CEO and his or her leadership team to look at all the potential in the company. And we do advise the CEO to look at the data with us, but to step back and not try to move a favorite, in other words, what, you know, generally tends to be a clone of the CEO, forward for many, many reasons, just because, one, it might be like a son to the CEO, does not mean that that person is going to be the most successful leader in the firm.
Well, it's interesting because not long ago, Pepsi-Cola named a new CEO, and it's a woman, and she has her roots in India.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, as you're talking, whether she went through any of these psychological tests that you're mentioning.
You bet.
And I'm not sure that she did, but I obviously have no way of knowing. But it seemed that what they were emphasizing when they announced her selection was that this is a woman who has a proven track record on the one hand. On the other hand, she's a woman, and there, you know, many of the buyers now are women. And thirdly, and perhaps even most importantly, they're living in a world environment, and she has a sensitivity to Asia, a major new market for the company, as well as other parts of the world. And I'm wondering how one might think about ranking the different skills in order to make a selection. For example, in a regional law firm, obviously it wouldn't be a worldwide perspective that would be important, but it would be a different perspective, a perspective perhaps of growth strategy, skill in dealing with colleagues, a skill in getting the respect of clients and the like. How do you go about ranking the various criteria that you might create in order to select your next leader?
That's a great question, Ed. And let me approach it this way by first referring to the reference that you made to Pepsi. PepsiCo, I know they're organizational psychologists. They have an entire team of them. And they absolutely do use psychological testing for their leaders. I've seen their process, and it's very elaborate and very effective. And that is the way that they go about selecting and looking at their succession planning. But I mentioned earlier that the succession planning process is a process. It's a strategy that's used that combines a lot of elements, includes a lot of elements. And that's part of what we do. You ask about growth strategies and skills and skill in dealing with colleagues and all of those things. We work with the client, and in this instance, our client is the CEO or the person that's trying to put succession planning in place. And we find out what their immediate interests are. And this brings up another point, and that is we always recommend that our clients do succession planning in conjunction with their strategic planning and their strategy building sessions when they're looking at the future. That's exactly the time when they need also to look at, so this is what's going to happen in the future, and then who's going to lead us in the future? What will the positions be? What will the needs be? What will those positions look like? And who might that be that's in our firm? And then they start looking in a very formal way, a very technical way, at who's in the firm, what they're made of as far as leadership talent. And from that process, we glean what the important to them is of various aspects of leadership. And we simply, it's not a simple process, but in essence, what we do is have them ranked, and then we run the data on the people that they have. And it's wonderful data, and it shows us very clearly who they have, what the traits and talents are in their leadership pool, and it becomes a process then of discussing. We don't do anything just from data, but then it becomes a further discussion process. The individuals that are showing up as highly talented and in line to be a head of firms, and then what it might take to groom those people and get them ready for those positions. First, of course, there has to be an interest from the people themselves to be in those positions.
Well, you know, your description is fascinating to me, because as you were talking, I recall a situation where I was on the board of directors of a volunteer organization, and as part of that process, 1 year we did a retreat, and at the retreat there was a woman who was very skilled in giving tests that describe your personality and how you approach things and the like. Mm-hmm. And her analysis of me was that I was primarily oriented to project completion, task completion. And while I understand that about me, give me a task, get out of my way, I'll get it done. Nevertheless, the entrepreneurial or team orientation aspect of my personality was significantly lower. And yet, today I am president of that very organization and doing a bang-up job. Everybody would say that I am, in effect, a team leader, and that I am not dominating, I am not using my orientation or my goals as the vehicle for getting the organization moving. Yeah. And so I have a suspicion about testing.
Yes.
And making a decision as important as choosing your next leader based on those kinds of testing. How do you mesh what I think is a real value in those tests with the selection process? And before you answer, let me give you a corollary. I grew up in the food industry, and at the time that I started, there was the computers were just coming in to use in the food industry. And some of the buyers were beginning to make decisions based on what the numbers on the computer runs showed, rather than walking the stores to see how the product moved and what the customers really were picking up and wanting.
Yes.
In other words, they became desk jockeys, making decisions only on the computers. My fear in what we're talking about is that decisions for leadership will be based on psychological testing, which may not be the right way to go. How would you respond to that?
It's a great question. You're my favorite interviewer, Ed, because you asked this great question. I'm very pleased that you brought up the testing situation, because we don't call it testing, for one thing. We call it leadership assessments, and there's a big difference. I would bet, I won't mention the test that I'll bet you had, but I bet I know it. We don't use it because it's not a valid test, and it's just for that very, very reason. When we're giving feedback to our the leaders or the potential leaders in other corporations who are our clients, we would never sit down and tell them that they are one thing, that they are that. What the person said about you, that you are a task completer. It's never, ever that simple. So if anyone in your listening audience is having someone sit down and tell them, you know, describe them in a few words like that, then throw the person out. That's not valid testing. I mentioned earlier that we never use just the test results as an indicator of anything. We use them in conjunction with many other data points, and most of that is conversation and sorting and sifting through the information that we've gathered in the time that we've been working with the firm. Just to get back very quickly to what an assessment battery might look like. We don't ever use just one assessment tool. We use a number of them. And because each one will tell us different things, and we're looking for as many of those data points as we can find to give the complete information about a person. We always give the information to the person first themselves in private, and we have them verify that what the information is showing, the data are showing, is accurate from their perception. And we talk about those things. It usually takes 1 or 2 hours to reflect the data back to the individual that has taken the assessment battery. And this serves two purposes. Number one, it verifies for us that our tests that are very valid tests, tried and true, are actually showing up as valid again in this instance. And it also has the individual who has gone through that battery of tests to look at themselves in different ways and understand themselves better and start to think about future preparation, where things are showing up as maybe not as great a strength as they would like, to assume higher level leadership roles. They can identify that early, long before they might be asked to, you know, to step into those roles and look at ways to fill in some gaps or think about things in a different way. So we just to recap, we would never characterize anybody in a very glib and imprecise way. There's always a very large array of things that a person is from a leadership perspective, and we're always reflecting those back.
You raise a very interesting question, and that is one of confidentiality. Obviously, as a psychologist, you have some of the same requirements as attorneys do with respect to confidentiality.
Yes.
When you speak to the individual in private, in confidence, you get a reaction of one sort or another.
Yes.
The whole point of this, however, is to communicate that those conclusions to management so that mm-hmm. they can then do something for the benefit of the individual, or if not, then at least for the benefit of the company. How do you overcome the issue of confidentiality? How are your test results or assessment results, if you will, utilized by somebody other than the individual?
Yes, good question. There are two reasons for our being in when we're using batteries of leadership assessments. One is when there are individuals that the CEO has determined needs some extra assistance and wants us to look at with him for rebuilding or replenishing that individual from a leadership perspective, leadership functioning perspective. In those cases, our agreement with, you know, where situations are a go or no-go, where there might be a go or no-go decisions made about that individual. Our agreement with our client, the CEO, is this, and it deals strictly with confidentiality. Then the individual that we are giving, or individuals that we're giving the leadership battery of assessments to, becomes our client. This is the agreement with the CEO. And we do reflect things back to that individual in the utmost confidence, but that information becomes that individual's information. We provide him or her with a full printout of what we've said to them. We go through it carefully with them and make sure they understand it. But it becomes their personal information. But we do ask them to submit a plan of action based on that information to the CEO. They don't have to say any of the specific details. They can if they wish. We encourage them to go on and sit down and talk with the CEO and just talk about things if they wish to. But we do ask that they submit a plan of action for the future of goals that they're going to try to meet. So that's the way we deal with corporate clients where there might be situations for needs for improvement. For the succession planning that we're talking about, it's a slightly different situation in that the people that are going into those assessment batteries are going in with a prior indication that they're interested in assuming leadership positions. So they do agree, they do sign agreements with us and with their CEO that they're perfectly willing to undergo the leadership assessment battery and have us talk to them. We do the same process, we talk to them first. But in that instance, the information is not confidential to the individual. It's gained in order to be shared both with them and with the CEO. But it requires their... they enter into it with a volunteer action.
So it's a waiver of confidentiality.
Exactly.
All right. Now, you mentioned earlier that the succession planning really is best approached when there is a strategic plan in place, and actually I would suspect that the individuals that we're talking about have already reached a level that they will probably participate in the development of the strategic plan. Am I correct?
No. Well, yes and no.
Well, now you're sounding like a lawyer. All right.
Exactly. Generally, the people in succession planning, and this is a factoid that needs to be stated, generally the people that we're talking about in succession planning might be a level or two below the leadership team that participates in strategic planning. So in order for, as part of the preparation process of this group, once we have identified the pool of candidates for higher level positions, is to then start to involve them in planning aspects of the company. But initially, typically, they would not be part of those very private sessions that generally are not more than 12 or 15 people.
All right, let's... come full circle now and ask the question, how does our discussion about succession planning relate to the legal profession and individual law practices, individual law firms in particular? How is it that law firms can or should use succession planning as we've described it and as we've discussed in their own operations?
The practice of law, and as it's based and grounded in law firms, is a natural condition for succession planning. But the downside of that for law firms is, much as I mentioned earlier, where a CEO, in this case the managing partner, gets sort of blinded by rather than looking at aspects of each individual that might be moving up from a factual perspective and a broader perspective, sometimes they get blinded by the fact that they just like the person, and the person is a good golf partner and so on and so forth. All of those things that tend to be more social aspects of the person rather than true management aspect.
In other words, because they're so close, they understand them so well, but while that's a positive, in most circumstances, it can also act as a negative, is what you're saying, I think.
Absolutely. The most usual pitfall of groups like groups of professionals and groups of engineers are like this, groups of lawyers and so on, is that one makes the assumption if they're great lawyers or they're great engineers, then they can do management. That's an absolute false assumption. Management is completely different and specialized field. The skills, in fact, for managers are not necessarily those that make a great lawyer or make a great engineer. So that's where one needs to be very careful in selecting a successor, not based on their being friends or so on, but on the skills that person might possess for leadership and management.
Billy, let me ask you one final question, and that would be, what particular points would you suggest to our listeners that they pay attention to in particular when thinking about the succession plan for their particular law firm?
I would think that they look carefully at the leadership potential there, and carefully and honestly, I would say, honestly to themselves. Again, as I've said, my caution would be that sometimes their friends and their closest associates, the folks that have been stellar performers in their practice of anything, practice of law and so on, won't necessarily be the best to head a firm. So, an honest assessment, and of course it might seem a bit biased, but an honest assessment is usually accomplished by a data-driven assessment. And again, we're not just going to use numbers, but that gets infusing some data into the process, gets the CEO or the organization's head away from strictly the social aspects of selecting a successor. And that's the greatest pitfall for small practices or small firms where people are known so well. That would be first step, and that again in our minds should be done with professionals that do this for a living, know these practices inside and out, and can sit down and go through a variety of processes and ask the right questions and assist in the thinking. And then the next step would be to design a succession plan, and that would be setting out, if the strategic planning hasn't already been done, that would be setting out where the firm is going to try to go in the future, what it's going to be like, what the changes are going to be, and then what kinds of leaders will need to be required for accepting those kinds of positions. And then the third step would be to look very carefully again, after you've gone through all the thinking process, at the people that are in the firm and what the true leadership skill might be. And that's at the point where you bring in the leadership assessments and get their buy-in for using those, and also get their interest, determine their interest in assuming responsibility for a firm, which is a big responsibility.
Well, Billy, I want to thank you for joining us today. It's a topic that is becoming more important as law firms become far more sophisticated in the business of law and must think about the next generation of leadership. Again, thanks for joining us today.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed it, Dad. Thank you.
You have been listening to a Law Biz podcast. For more podcasts, please visit www.lawbiz.com/podcasts.html. Feel free to tell your friends and colleagues about Law Biz podcasts. You may duplicate this program in part or in whole, provided that you retain appropriate attribution and copyright notices.